Hey everybody, welcome into the Cubs Weekly Podcast presented by Wintrust, proud legacy partner of the Chicago Cubs, an exclusive home of Cubs Checking. I'm Tony Andriacki, joined by Andy Martinez, and special guest on the pod today, Joe Girardi, former big league manager and big league catcher. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this was quite the road trip for the Cubs. I mean, anytime you're going on the West Coast, it's certainly like a daunting task. Then when you have a 10-day, 9-game road trip, right, where it's three teams, it's the Mariners, it's the Padres, it's the Diamondbacks, three teams that have their eyes set on the postseason. Joe, what do you make overall? Cubs go 5-4. Like, what is your summation of this road trip for the Cubs?
I was impressed by the road trip. When you lose game one, when you're up 8-0, and you lose that game, you're thinking, oh boy, here we go. This is going to be a rough road trip. They bounce back, win the next day. They lose the, you know, the third one against the Padres. But then they respond really well. They lose the first one to Seattle, win the next two. And I think it's a great road trip. Anytime you can go out west and have a positive road trip where you have more wins than losses, I go like this.
It's kind of overlooked how tough it is to go out west. Like the travel, the time difference. I remember Sean Marshall telling us on the podcast how your body just gets all thrown for a loop. So for them to show resiliency, not only coming back after that, blowing that 8-0 game, and then the tough extra inning games in the second game against Arizona, what does that say about the resilience that they've kind of shown really all season long?
Well, I think it shows you they learned a lot from last year. Let's go to September last year where they were 4-12. And they hadn't won a road series since they won the road series in Pittsburgh in late August. And they come out and do what they did on this road trip. It shows that there's good leadership. And they have the ability to turn the page. You play every day in this game. And you got to just, whatever happened the night before or the day before, you just got to go, it's gone, right? There's nothing we can do about it. Let's go out and play a clean game and play the best of our ability and be prepared. And if you do that, a lot of times when you're a talented team, you're going to win. And I think they've shown that. The other thing that's been impressive is how the young kids that maybe they weren't expecting to count on so early have played so well. I mean, you get 10 games started by rookies and they've won 8 of them. There's no other team. They've had more games started by rookie pitchers than anyone in baseball. The Giants and the Dodgers are second, 7 going into today. So I think that has been really impressive.
Yeah, and I think, too, just the injuries that they've had to face and the reason why some of these young guys have had to step up. But, you know, Julian Merriweather is a big key to the bullpen. They lose him right before the road trip starts. In the middle of the road trip, Seiya Suzuki, arguably their best player overall, or best offensive player, they lose him right before the Arizona series starts. And obviously this whole time has been without Justin Steele and Jameson Taillon to date. So in order to, like, get through all of that, I agree. I think it shows this level of resiliency. And, like, if you had told me, even without any of those injuries, if you had told me that the Cubs just went 5-4 on this road trip, I would have been impressed. But yeah, given the fact that they could have even gone 7-2 on this road trip without those couple of really tough losses, first one in San Diego and second one in Arizona, I'm just impressed with the way that they've been able to just turn the page, the phrase that you use, Joe, and move on. And so you talk about leadership, though, Joe. Like, what is it about leadership that trickles down? And is this more of like a council thing? Or how do you think that shows up on the field the way that it does?
I think it's both. I think they feel good about the guy that is leading them, and he's been there and done that sort of thing. He's been a World Series champion as a player. He's won a number of divisions in Milwaukee. He understands what it takes to win. But I also think it's the veteran guys in the room that know that, hey, this is a long season. Don't make too much of a week. Don't make too much of a three-game series. And let's even go a little bit deeper. They've played 12 of their 18 games on the road. This tough road trip, and they went to the team that won the World Series last year. I mean, they have not had an easy schedule. Oh, and let's not forget, they played the Dodgers at home. So they are off to a fantastic start. They have the third best record in the National League. Really, really impressive what they've done so far.
With Seiya Suzuki's injury, I know Tony talks about him. How do you expect the Cubs offense to kind of pick up his what his presence is, and what do you do when someone like that, a big impact like that, goes down?
Well, I think what they'll do is they'll platoon Tauchman and Canario in right field. And the one thing that you want to make sure is that everyone on the team doesn't start trying to do too much. You can't replace Seiya Suzuki. You can't. But those two guys can hold down the fort and do a really good job. And Tauchman had a very good game on Wednesday. He made some really good defensive plays on Tuesday. Canario had a very good game on Tuesday night. Just contribute. I mean, they both hit some doubles, driven in runs in these games. And that's what you expect from Seiya. But you don't have to do it alone. You have a partner that's going to help you, and you're always going to be in a favorable matchup. So I think that's how they'll do it.
Joe, talking all these injuries, I mean, I would say put yourself in Council's shoes. You obviously have been in those shoes before as a big league manager of dealing with a bunch of injuries, things that you can't predict. You can never predict how a season's going to go. You know you're going to need more than the 26 guys you break camp with. But so many injuries so early on, and especially early on in a tenure for Council to in a new place, obviously wants to get off to a good start. You lose Justin Steele on opening day. You don't have Jameson Taillon at all yet. Patrick Wisdom hasn't played yet. We already talked about Merriweather and Saya. But if you're in that manager seat, like, how do you navigate that and keep the guys galvanized after such a road trip, or just even in general with all the injuries?
You know that no one's going to feel sorry for you. That's the first thing as a manager. You know that every team's going to go through it, and we just have to ride it out. And I think Craig is the same every day, whether they win or lose. He comes in the same. He's prepared. He knows what he wants to do in every situation. He lets the guys know what they're going to do. I mean, if you think about the press conference he had before the game on Wednesday with Arizona, he talked about Hayden Wesneski is going to play an important role in this game at some point. Hayden knew when he walked through those doors that, hey, I need to be prepared, and I'm not going to be surprised because I'm going to pitch today. And Jordan Wicks had thrown pretty well through 4 1/3 innings, or 4 2/3, but Hayden came in and did a great job. And I think preparing players, showing them that you have confidence in them, which he has done, like he told Christopher Morrell that I'm going to put you in one position, you're going to be there every day,
yeah.
Right? It's exactly what he's done. His word means something to these guys. He told Hayden he was going to play an important role. His word meant something. Hayden came in the fifth inning and rolled all the way into the ninth inning. So I think that's important, because then all of a sudden, when a manager's saying, I believe in you, you start to believe in yourself. And that's really important in this game, because there's so much failure.
And Andy, I mean, just talking about Wesneski, do you want to talk just about like how important the role is that Wesneski played? As Joe said, you know, going from the fifth to the ninth, but it was a tired, beleaguered bullpen after back-to-back extra inning games against the Diamondbacks earlier this season.
Yeah, I mean, the bullpen's been used so heavily early on in this season, and the biggest thing that I took away from it was you were down Neris, you were down probably Alzolay, you were probably down. You were down Almonte. I probably thought Smiley would have been down, but 3 days or 2 days back-to-back for the first time on Wednesday. To have all those guys down, and then
Leiter had pitched like 3 out of the last 4.
Right. He was down.
Right. Yeah. All these situations where you're down so much that you had to option guys that, you know, I thought Luke Little has been pitching well, and I think it was just, I don't think it was you had one bad outing. I think it was more so you have options, you have to go down, and we got to bring some fresh arm up. I thought that to me that was to have Hayden Wesneski cover 4 innings and then be able to go to Smiley to get the final outs. I think that sets you up, because if you look at Thursday's game against Miami, you're probably have a pitch limits or an inning limit with Taillon, so you're going to need your bullpen. So to be able to save some of those arms, Neris, Alzolay, all these guys, I think that's so crucial from Wesneski to provide that cover.
Yeah, it's really important that you have guys in your bullpen that can give you multiple innings. And there's a couple starters coming back, and I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen, and you can't ever predict, you know, does someone else get nicked up and he goes in the IL. But now all of a sudden you're starting to see some guys that can give you multiple innings, whether it's Keegan Thompson, okay, Hayden Wesneski. Does Ben Brown stay in the rotation? If he doesn't, you know that he can give you multiple innings. Those guys become really important on days like Wednesday, when they didn't have all their relievers and we needed someone to go 3 or 4 innings. That is huge. I mean, that is so big for a bullpen. So now they have options. So if one guy is tired or that you need a fresh arm, just go get him. And the big thing for the kids, right, is stay ready, because the phone's going to ring. And you don't want to be the guy that's not ready to go because you feel bad for yourself that I got sent down and I didn't deserve to be sent down. You're right. You didn't deserve to be sent down. But it's part of the game, and it's part about a bigger picture, and that's winning a championship.
And obviously, to win a championship, you do need to win in April. But that being said, Joe, I mean, can you explain maybe to the listeners, to the viewers, of why you don't want to tax your bullpen in April and why it might be different in April versus like August or September or something in a pennant race?
Right. The reason you don't want to tax them in April is because they won't be worth a darn in July, August, and September. And that's when you need guys to be really good, because you're fighting to get into the playoffs. And if you do get in the playoffs and you're fortunate enough, you don't want a tired bullpen. You want a bullpen that's, you've shared the innings, and this is a bullpen that's been taxed because the starters haven't given them a lot of distance. And they've almost, it's almost 50-50 innings in the bullpen and innings by starters. And that's going to change because the starters are going to get more built up. And you don't want to blow out the starters in the first month either by pushing them too far, ask them to go 110 pitches, because then you got a problem with starting pitching. So it's sharing everything in the beginning. And when you have more than eight guys that can do the job in the bullpen, you have 11, 12, 13 guys that can give you multiple innings. You can do that. And all of a sudden, instead of everyone have 70 appearances, they got 55, 60, 65. And it means something when you're getting tired and you're in the dog days of August and September.
I do want to ask you on someone, one of those guys that has pitched 70 games in seasons consistently, Hector Neris. You had him in Philly. How valuable, first of all, is a guy like that that can seemingly go every day? He went 3 days in a row. But also, what are you seeing from him early? It seems like he's close, but it's like not fully there yet.
He just doesn't have his fastball command yet. And I think it's just a little mechanical. It's just kind of leaking away from lefties and into righties. And his split's doing that a little bit. He's not far off. I actually thought the third day in a row that he threw was the best he was. And maybe that's because he was a little bit fatigued and wasn't trying to give a little extra. Sometimes a guy that throws 94, 95 early on the year when he's throwing 92, 93, he's trying to give a little bit extra. And that gets you in trouble. Hector's very resilient. Hector's a fantastic human being that's great in the clubhouse, who loves to have fun, who expects a lot from himself, and is very durable. And he's really important to this bullpen.
When Andy first brought up Hector's name, you kind of had a smile on your face.
Was
there like a specific reason or something you just thought of immediately?
I just love him. I used to play a game of cards called Casino with him. And I tried to relate it to pitching about, it's not always about going as hard as you can. It's about having a little finesse. And the way we play Casino was, it's a game that it's a points, and you had to hit 21 exactly. And in each hand, there's 11 points. So if it was 18 to 18, one of us has got a sandbag to get to 21. Because if you go over, you go back to where you were. And there were games that would take 4 or 5 hours to play. If you just played regular and the first one 21, it's like 3 or 4 hands and the game's over. So it was trying to teach him that there's got to be a little finesse in your game sometimes, and it can't be just go hard all the time. And he was a little hesitant in the beginning to play the game and trying to understand it, but then he fell in love with it, and I had so much fun with Hector.
That's an awesome story. I love hearing that kind of stuff. We're going to take a quick break here on the Cubs Weekly Podcast. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Kyle Hendricks' start to the season and Christopher Morel's defense at third base.
You've got the jersey, the ball cap, the foam finger. Everyone can see you're a Chicago Cubs fan from a mile away. Ready to take your look to the next level? Upgrade your wallet with an exclusive Cubs debit card, which you can get when you open a Wintrust Cubs checking account. With no monthly fees, free ATMs nationwide, and a $300 bonus when you open your account. Start showing your Cubs pride with every purchase. Sign up at Wintrust.com/Cubs. Only $100 required to open. No monthly minimum balance and no monthly maintenance fees. Member FDIC and equal housing lender.
Hey everybody, welcome back into the Cubs Weekly Podcast. I'm Tony Andracki, Andy Martinez, and Joe Girardi. And Joe, you have a baseball now, so he comes fully equipped with some equipment here. But let's talk a little bit about, as promised, Kyle Hendricks. The season has not gone off the way that he or the Cubs would have liked, for sure. An ERA over 12, it's something that I'm not used to seeing next to Kyle Hendricks' name after four outings here. It seems to be like a lot of different things, essentially. You know, he's given up a lot of home runs. He has been unlucky. It seems like he's walking more guys and stuff in general. But Joe, I'm just curious, like, first four starts in, what have you seen from him and what looks different?
Well, to me, I have a couple props. I have a ball and I have a strike zone, right? That's about the size of a strike
zone. It is, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So his misses are usually this way, off the strike zone, right? His misses have been inside the strike zone, and they call the shadow, if this is the strike zone, one ball in, one ball above, or one ball in, one ball out. He's missing by more than one, so he's not in the shadow, and he's not overpowering, so his late movement and being on the edges is how he has to live. I know he plays Sweet Emotion by Aerosmith, but it should be Living on the Edge, right, is what it should be. And he was much better at it last year. There were times he wasn't good at it. He gave up 6 home runs in a 2-game span last year, and now he's given up 5 or 6 in a 4-game span. So he has to just get back to the edges. He still has movement on his sinker. He still has movement on his change. It's been a little inconsistent, the movement on it. But it's just location, location, location. And it's so important for him. And when he doesn't locate, he gets in trouble.
So I do want to ask on that. Do you think it's mechanical? Is it mental? Is it a little bit of both? Like, how do you get
back? I think it starts off mechanical, and then it becomes a little bit mental. Because no matter who you are, no matter how much success you've had in this game, when things don't go your way for a couple of games, you start thinking, okay, I got to make big adjustments. I got to do something here. And I don't think it's a big adjustment. And I think they can iron this out and he can get back. He's never going to be a guy that gives you eight innings. That's not who he is anymore. He was that guy at one time, but every pitcher gets to the point where you get through the lineup two and a half times. That's fantastic. We'll take it and turn it over to the bullpen. So I think he will get it turned around.
Yeah, and actually last year, you know, coming back from the injury, he averaged nearly six innings a start, which I think was impressive, you know, his age 33 season. But something as I was diving into Hendricks' start here, his rough outings, I was struck by the fact that he's always struggled in April and March. And I knew that, but to the extent, I've been really surprised. So in March and April, the first month-ish of the season, he has a 5.58 ERA and a WHIP 1.46. Every other month after, so basically from May 1st on, including, you know, every month of the regular season, 3.29 ERA, 1.12 WHIP. So basically he is like the professor that we know from May 1st on, and for whatever reason, in April and in March, whenever his first five or so outings of the season, he struggles. And I think it goes back to like the mechanics, and he's been talking about it. I know if they fully knew the answer, they would figure it out, especially Hendricks, who, you know, is in his 11th big league season. Like, he would figure out how to resolve this issue. For whatever reason, his mechanics just are not locked in coming out of spring. So it's like last year everything was great because he was injured and he didn't start until late May, and yeah, then everything was great. So I don't know how the Cubs like resolve this issue. I don't know where they go moving forward, but like, you know, Joe, if you are the Cubs, like, how do you solve this problem? Like, you're not going to just give up on Hendricks.
No, you ride it out. You ride it out for, you know, at least 2 months for me, because you got to believe that the pedigree that he has is going to change. I had a hitter in Mark Teixeira. Slow start every year, and we tried so many different things. We tried changing his spring training routine. We tried playing him every day the last week and a half. We tried giving him more at-bats, less at-bat. And every year looked up, he had 30 and 100. I mean, it was the way it was. It can become where you start to believe that I'm just a slow starter. And for whatever reason, and you got to remember a lot of times, he's a feeling guy. You know, he wants to feel his changeup, you know. He's got to feel that sinker, and he's not like a power guy that just grips it and lets it rip. That's not who he is. So I think when you're a feeling pitcher guy, sometimes the weather's not really conducive early in the year.
And I think, too, he's found ways to try to combat other struggles he's had. So I remember a few years ago, he had a lot of first-inning struggles. It seemed like for whatever reason, teams were jumping on him. So he found a way. One of the ways that he tried to get through that was in his pregame bullpen, where normally he would just throw to the catcher. He started having like Tommy Hotovy or another coach like stand in the box, and maybe particularly from the left side, and kind of pretend like that was his first inning, and then go out to the mound mentally and it's his second inning and settle in. You know, and I'm sure there were varying results from that, but it is really kind of funny to me that even a guy like Kyle Hendricks, who has had so much success, who is an ERA leader, won a World Series, pitched game seven of a World Series, still has some of these struggles where, like, in some ways, it's kind of the beauty of the game, where it's like no matter how much success you've had, no matter how intelligent you are, you still just cannot beat the game of baseball sometimes.
There's always self-doubt in this game because there's failure. And it's something that you have to deal with every day. And I think he's really strong mentally, and I think he'll be able to deal. But you were talking about having Tommy Hotovy step in. Roger Clemens used to do the same thing. Whatever the lineup was, if it was left, right, left, right, left, left, he'd have you stand in, and he would go through the first three hitters. But I remember one day I was standing in, and he said, okay, up and in, fastball up and in. And I'm going, wait a minute now. So I put my glove on and stood there and made sure, like, if it's really coming up and in, I'm going to catch it. I'm not going to let him knock me down. But, I mean, you have to play those games with yourself to prepare yourself. And I think he's smart enough to figure this out.
Another guy who's kind of going through, like, the mental hoops, I guess, is Christopher Morel, right, with getting reps at third base. And I talked to him, and one of the things – for him about third base is just getting into the mental routine of like, hey, you can do these plays. And we talked about it last week on the pod about when he had the error against Colorado, he had plenty of time, but he rushed the throw and he throws it past the first baseman. The two pitches later, the ball comes to him and he has time to kind of compose himself, take time and make the clean, accurate throw. As Christopher Morel's been getting more and more time at third base, what have you seen from him defensively? And, you know, seemed like that series against Arizona was almost like a coming out party in terms of his defensive work.
He made some fantastic plays. The one thing that is really important with infielders is they understand their internal clock, right? So what do I mean by that? You have to understand how long it takes you to get the ball across the infield, but more important, you have to understand how much time you have once you feel it. You need to know the speed of the runner. You need to know, am I turning a double play? You need to anticipate what you're going to do. If it's a slow roller and he's a fast guy and I don't have a chance, what we say is eat it. Just eat the ball, right? Don't try to make a spectacular play. And I think he's learning a lot. Like the other day, he made a double play. There was runners on first and second. Ball hit to him, stepped on third, composed himself, and threw it about 95 across the diamond. But he knows that he has that arm, and he has to understand that he has the arm to make up some time. He can play really deep. So I was really impressed because when he struggled defensively in the first few games, he was swinging. And then when he was struggling offensively, you would expect those defensive struggles to come back. They never did. And that's a really good sign to me. And I think he's starting to understand. And here's the thing. He's not in left one day, in center one day, and right at second. He's just been at third base, and you learn a lot quicker when you're only in one spot.
Andy, you know, you had a great story at MarquiseSportsNetwork.com last week about exactly what Joe was talking about, that Morrell, even as a young player, has found a way to separate his defense and offense. You'd think that'd be very difficult to do, especially given the fact that he hasn't been at one position. But what did you learn from going through that story and talking to Cubs coaches about how he and the Cubs are able to separate those two facets?
He really focused this offseason about taking whether it was a great moment or great play or a horrible play, horrible moment, and forgetting about it. If he hits a grand slam one inning, it doesn't matter when he goes and plays defense. If he has an error in one inning, it doesn't matter that next batter when he's playing defense. And he showed that in Colorado, against Colorado, where he makes an error, leads to a run, and then he composes himself and he gets the next out. I think that to me was the most encouraging sign, is that he's learning to kind of flush it. And you talked about, you know, whether or not you have a good or bad day, you forget it. It's in the past. As a young player, that's really not easy to do. And he's admitted he's not perfect. Like, he doesn't have it yet, up like fully down, but he's getting there, and that's encouraging.
The reason it's not easy, because you're afraid that someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, the man wants to see you.
Yeah.
And when the man wants to see you, you're usually going down, right? So that's what you worry about every day as a young player. If you're established and you hit 100 for 2 weeks and you've been in the big leagues and had a lot of success, you don't worry about anything. You just worry about working on your mechanics. You don't worry about, God, if I don't get a hit today, they're going to send me down. Or I make another error, they're not going to play me at third base. That's really hard to do. I think his personality works really well, too. Now, I don't know him really well, but he's happy-go-lucky.
Yeah.
And I think he's really thankful for every day that he's on a baseball field. I think he truly appreciates it and loves it. So no matter what happens, he's going to have fun. And I think that really helps him in these situations.
And Joe, you were talking earlier just about the consistency of being in one position on the field. I've been struck by early in the season the consistency of the Cubs lineup, like meaning 1 through 9. Obviously, the last three in the order maybe change a little bit, but it seems to me that there has been more, certainly before Suzuki got injured, that 1 through 6, 1 through 7 really seem to be consistent all along. And I know, you know, from an analytics perspective, like, the lineup construction is something that's overblown, I think, from you know, those of you guys inside the game, managers, front office members, and whatever. From fans, it's overblown in the sense of, like, who's leading off? Well, this guy should be hitting second, this guy should be hitting fourth, and so on. But can you kind of just take in the mindset of, like, as a manager, you want to manage the analytics that tell you it doesn't really matter how the lineup is constructed, with the human component of the game of, like, this guy likes hitting leading off, this guy likes hitting cleanup, this guy wants to know where he's hitting each day, and so on.
So I went through a valuable exercise when I was with the Phillies when we acquired Kyle Schwarber. So we had two big bats, really big bats, in Kyle Schwarber and Bryce Harper. And I wanted to separate them enough that if you brought in a lefty, you wouldn't necessarily see both of them. So I didn't want them 1 and 3 or 2 and 4 or 3 and 5. I wanted to spread them out. So I went through these exercises like, okay, if I put them 1 and 4, what does it do? If I put them 2 and 5, what does it do? If they're 3 and 6, what does it do? And I'm racking my brain on what the lineup should be, right? It was a difference of 2 runs over 162 games. So what I realized is I spend way too much time on this, right? Put the guys in a consistent spot so when they go into the ballpark and they look at the lineup, they're in the same spot every day. Because I also think hitters work together, right? So if Kyle's, you know, somewhat around the same people all the time, they're going to talk to each other about what they see. And I think that's really important. And there's a comfortability factor for a player because, like, I've always thought, like, if I hit a guy 2 one day and then I hit him 6 one day and then I hit him 8 one day, what does he think? Well, if he's hit me 2, he believes I'm going to have a good day. If he's hit me 8, he thinks I can't hit this guy. That's the last thing message I ever want to send to a player. So I think the most important thing, and I think Craig has done it, he's getting his best hitters up the most. So whether they're 2 and 3 or 1 and 3, he's just saying it's not going to matter that much. I want these guys to hit the most, and that's what he's doing.
And one thing he always talks about is he just wants guys to have consistent at-bats and good at-bats, right? If you stack them up, it really doesn't matter. Oftentimes than not, that leadoff hitter is hitting first once, right?
Once. Because
it doesn't really matter whether or not you're a true leadoff hitter, quote-unquote, because Craig just wants them to have good at-bats. And I think we're seeing that up and down the lineup. And whether it's Seiya Suzuki at 2 or Dansby Swanson at 2, the at-bat and the approach seems to be consistent all the way throughout.
And can you imagine trying to predict what 10 days Christopher Morel was going to hit 7 homers and what 10 days he wasn't going to?
Right.
If you could do that, I mean, you might as well just go into gambling, right?
Right.
So you just can't. It's hard to predict when players are going to have their good weeks and bad weeks. It's a lot of it has to do with the guy on the other side. Does he paint on me for, you know, those 4 bats where the week before they were making mistakes on me and I was taking advantage, and now all of a sudden I'm not getting any pitch? It's just really hard to predict. So I think the consistency in the lineup has helped the guys a lot. I think they're comfortable and they know where they are every day. Every once in a while, you got to give a guy a day off and you got to make an adjustment, but it's hard to predict.
Yeah, and I think with Seiya out, it's definitely going to be an exercise for Craig Counsell to try to navigate. You know, there's your 2-hole hitter and your most consistent hitter throughout this season. So it'll definitely be something that bears watching over the next few weeks in this season until Suzuki returns. But that'll do it for this edition of the Cubs Weekly Podcast. For Joe and Andy, I'm Tony. Thanks for tuning in.